This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It is unclear whether the Middle East peace process will be one of the casualties of Friday's massacre in Hebron. On Friday, Dr. Baruch Goldstein, an extremist Jewish settler in the West Bank, shot down Palestinian Muslims praying at a mosque. About 40 Palestinians were killed. Over 20 people have died in rioting that followed the massacre. The PLO says it won't return to the table unless Israel disarms the settlers. Israel says that is an unacceptable condition. My guest Milton Viorst has written about the Middle East for The New Yorker magazine. His 1987 book, Sands of Sorrow, Israel's Journey from Independence, was critical of Israel. His new book, Sandcastles, The Arabs in Search of the Modern World, casts a critical eye on the Arab world for its secular and religious despotism. I asked Viorst about his personal reaction to the massacre.
Well, it's hard not to be appalled. Of course I'm appalled and shocked and overwhelmed by the magnitude of this tragedy. But it doesn't come, alas, as a terrible surprise. I mean, we've all known about terrorists, and we all know that there are terrorists on both sides of the fence on this question. And there is a deep sense of entitlement, not just by these Jewish extremists, but by an entire community out there. And they really believe that the Arabs have no business in this land, although they've inhabited it without interruption for a couple of thousand years, that the Bible entitles them so strongly to take it over that there is no questioning it, even though there are a lot of people in the region who don't for whom the Bible is not the first source of religious or real estate authority. And it's just a terrible thing that you can believe in your own cause so deeply, I think, that one would engage in an act of this sort. And what is so shocking is that it obviously has the support, as we have seen, of a lot of Dr. Goldstein's friends and supporters.
How typical do you think Goldstein is of the settlers in the territories?
Well, there are 130,000 settlers. Of those, perhaps 100 or 110,000 are people who moved out there because the government gave them tax breaks, and it was very advantageous to do so. But the whole thing began with the handful and finally grew into 10 or 15 or 20,000 who went out there because of a deep ideological conviction that this is what Zionism and Israel was all about. This was, as they say, King David never lived in Tel Aviv. He lived up in the mountains, and he lived in and around Jerusalem and Hebron. So they say this is more important to Zionism than is the coastal area, where the real concentration of the Jewish population is.
Do you see the massacre as the action of a lunatic, or more as the inevitable outcome of Israel's former encouragement of settlers in the occupied territories?
Well, it is the work of a lunatic. I don't think that former Prime Minister Begin would ever come out and say, yes, we have to massacre people. But nonetheless, there is a body of ideology which the Likud government under Menachem Begin made extremely popular. It became a guiding light after the Six-Day War of 1967, when so many Israelis began to think that this was a statement by God endorsing, authorizing the expansion of Israel. There was a whole shift in Orthodox thinking in Israel after the Six-Day War. Prior to that, the religious orthodoxy held that an Israeli government was a secular government, and we are waiting for the Messiah, and we're not interested in secularism. We are religious people. Suddenly, after the Six-Day War, they shifted and said, well, this is God's signal showing us that we must take over the whole land. And so the thrust of Orthodox ideology shifted, and these fellas are out there as the gunmen. They're doing the job.
Do you think it's hard to change the attitudes of militant settlers after they've been encouraged to go out there? In other words, just because government policy changes and there's a peace process underway, would you expect that people who are ideologues and extremists would change too?
No, it's going to be very hard to get these people back into the box. What happened is that Begin opened this jack-in-the-box thing. They came out, getting them back, getting saying that the government has shifted policy again, and we are now discouraging settlements because our policy is to make peace with the Palestinians. We regard that as far more important to Israel and to the future of our state, some position I agree with, of course. But these people do not agree with that. They think that peace is a secondary concern. Their definition of peace is driving the Arabs out, subduing the Arabs, making sure they are no longer in a position to continue the conflict. That's peace. They don't have any notion of compromise. There are times in every society's history, I suppose, when the most inflammatory people, the most fanatical people, prevail. And for a while, they were prevailing. The movement is against them now. The tide has turned. They know that. And that's the source of such desperate acts as took place in Hebron.
What Israel has done so far since the massacre includes, for the first time, the army has closed off Jewish settlements in predominantly Palestinian Hebron. It's created a commission to investigate the massacre. It plans for the release of up to 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. The army has issued orders for the immediate administrative detention of 5 settlers presumed to be members of the militant Koch party. And the government may take guns away from about 20 other militant settlers. Arafat has said that what Israel has done so far is really a collection of empty, hollow gestures. What would the PLO like to see Israel do in response to the massacre?
Well, what I guess the PLO would like is to see some steps that will end the Jewish settlements in the West Bank. I think that much of Israel now, and certainly the Palestinians, recognize that the presence of all of these Jewish settlers, and I'm talking about those I called the commuters before, as well as the militants, is not compatible with Palestinian rule over the territory. There are 600,000 or 700,000 Arabs living in Israel. So presumably there is something of a mirror image. And one could say, well, if you have all of these Arabs in Israel, why not have the Jews under Palestinian rule? Except the Arabs in Israel acknowledge the sovereignty of the Israeli government. They are not challenging it. They live under it. They pay taxes. They vote. They go to schools. They live in peaceful and harmonious relations with the Israeli government. The settlers in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip operate under a totally different ideology. They are there in order to govern. They are there in order to rule. They have made very clear, there is no doubt about this. This is not any revelation. This is based upon their own statements. They are there to assure that the Palestinians cannot take over the territories. They feel that this territory has got to be under Jewish rule. And as long as they are there, it is unimaginable that the Palestinians can run a successful political administration because you have 130,000 of the enemy right there in your midst. And if they are being safeguarded by the Israeli army, no matter how much the Israeli army's presence is reduced, it still makes it inconceivable, in my judgment, that the Palestinians can run a successful administration and to show that they can govern themselves, which is what the whole point of the transition from through the autonomy process is all about. I think that Israel has, this is a warning to the Israelis, and many, as I say, many Israelis know this, that they have got to put an end to the settlements.
The issue of Jewish settlements wasn't supposed to really come up in the peace talks till about two years from now. And the Palestinians are saying this has to be addressed immediately.
Well, the internal politics of Israel, because the settlers' movement has grown so great, has gotten out of hand, because Begin, in a sense, was vindicated by now having 130,000 Israelis living in the territories, they have become a very powerful political force. And an even grossly disproportionately powerful political force, because their threat of violence intimidates all Israelis. No Israelis want civil war between Jews and Jews. That's quite understandable. So as long as these people out in the territory say, if you really attempt to take these territories away from us, you are risking a war of Jews against Jews. So Rabin has been frightened by this. Any political leader might very well be frightened about this. I think in his heart of hearts, Rabin has a certain sympathy for them, except I think he also is practical enough to understand that that their position is untenable if Israel is to survive over the course of the future in some sort of reasonable relationship with its neighbors. But the fact is that they are so powerful that Rabin decided he wasn't going to take them on. Let's get some sort of agreement signed with the Palestinians. Let's get the process going. And two, three, four years from now, we'll see what the situation is with the settlers. And I think that what this episode indicates is that's naive, because the settlers are so committed to stopping the entire process, reversing the entire process of peacemaking, that it will be impossible to put the issue off for another few years.
When you talk about civil war, are you talking about the possibility of Jews taking up weapons to fight other Jews in Israel over the issue of the territories?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, that's not my observation. They have said it themselves.
They being the settlers?
The settlers have said it, that if somebody, if the army comes in and tries to do anything, they will shoot down. Well, during the time of the negotiation of the peace treaty with Egypt, the settlers made the same threats to the Israeli army, and indeed did resist, although not very vigorously, but they did physically resist the dismantling of the settlements in the Sinai. There is the famous incident of Yamit, where they fought off the army. Nobody was killed, because mostly it was with stones and rocks and that sort of thing, but they fought off the army for days before they finally agreed to leave the territories, and they only finally agreed because they were there, because of their having been bought off with a huge amount of money. I think the same thing will probably be true for the settlers in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They will have to be bought off with a substantial amount of money, too.
What do you mean, yes, bought off by money?
Well, you give up your homes in the territories, and we will give you X shekels, yen, dollars, whatever it may be, to set up homes in Israel proper. But the settlers in Yamit, which was a small town set up after 1967 in the Sinai, made a huge amount of money from the Israeli, and absolutely outraging many Israelis, many unsympathetic Israelis, who saw this as extortion, and it was a form of extortion. Let's be honest with it. And many of the 130,000 who are out there now would be quite contented to go back to Israel proper, because they are not of an ideological bent. If they got enough money to justify their return, that means, let's say, comparable homes inside Israel proper. But the ideologues, this crowd that did the shooting over the weekend, feel that money is not the issue. I mean, what they are talking about is deeply rooted ideology. And I think it's quite possible that they will be willing to wage civil war against Israel, and they may very well have to be driven out by force, although maybe when the time comes, they'll back down. But so far, they're not backing down.
My guest is Milton Viorst. He's covered the Middle East for The New Yorker and has a new book called Sandcastles, The Arabs in Search of the Modern World. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Milton Viorst. Goldstein, the gunman in the massacre, wanted to stop the peace process, and it looks like it's temporarily grinding to a halt. The PLO, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan have broken off from the peace talks, which were scheduled for this week. What are the pressures on the PLO to pull out, and the pressures on the PLO to go forward?
Well, it's not, I don't think the proper, I don't think it's proper at this stage, at least, to see it in terms of pressures. I think both Israel and the PLO at this point have made a political / strategic decision that they're going to make peace with each other. Both sides are very uncomfortable. Neither side sees very clearly where this is all going, but both sides have acknowledged that the self-interest of themselves and their people requires them to make peace. That is not to say that peace should be mistaken for sellout. Clearly, Dr. Goldstein and his friends think Israel is selling out, and the Hamas people and many other Palestinians feel that the PLO is selling out. Nobody particularly likes the terms on either side. My sense, nonetheless, is that both sides are so totally committed to making peace that after some reasonable period of face-saving and stomping and jumping up and down and making clear how angry you are and, in a sense, basically gratifying the needs of the political opposition within both camps in order to present some kind of semblance of consensus for the next stage, then the peace process will resume. It may take a few days. I don't think it's going to take more than a few weeks. I think they're probably going to get back to it.
Meir Kahane, who was the leader of the far right, or at least one of the leaders of the far right in Israel, is from Brooklyn, New York. And Goldstein, the killer in the massacre, he's from Brooklyn, New York, too. Do you have any idea of the strength of Jewish extremist groups in the United States now?
Well, they are very strong, but I think they're also very small. An awful lot of them have gone to Israel. I think if you go back and look at the history, the Jewish Defense League was formed to defend Jewish neighborhoods against blacks, whom they felt were besieging them. They were extremists then, and they have shifted gears and moved their activities largely to Israel and to the occupied territories, and now, of course, direct their activity against Arabs, conjuring up all of the terrible things that have ever happened to Jews over the course of centuries. I see that there are frequent statements in the press over the course of the past few days calling the Arabs Arab Nazis and Nazis. You know, the Arabs, one can criticize the Arabs for much if one wants to, but Nazis have nothing to do with it. There was never a Holocaust as long as Jews lived in the Arab world. It wasn't the happiest of marriages, but for over the course of 2,000 years or somewhere thereabouts, Jews and Arabs lived closely together and rather well. The problems between the Arab world and Israel and the Jews only arose with the politicization of the problem by when somebody said, well, we Jews will give up our communities in Damascus and Baghdad and elsewhere where they have lived since biblical times and concentrate in a land called Israel where we will set up our own sovereign state. That the Arabs found objectionable. They were unfamiliar with it. They didn't like it. They didn't want the Jews to do that. But when Jews lived among Arabs over the course of so many centuries, it was rather harmonious. And so when I see the Kahane people, the Dr. Goldstein people, referring to the Arabs as Nazis, as Begin did, it might be said, in order to arouse this kind of sentiment among the Jews of Israel. It really has no historical justification at all.
Has it been very difficult for you as a Jewish journalist to cover the Middle East and still be seen as being fair?
Well, sure. I was much criticized by the Jewish community in the United States for saying critical things about Israel. But my response to this, as much as we all hate to be criticized, I was a consenting adult. I knew what I was doing. And I made a decision that I would absorb this criticism if I had to, in order to write what I felt was necessary to write. Well, the same thing is probably true in the Arab world. It's a little bit different, I've got to say, because it's one thing to criticize your own people, and it's something else to criticize another people. I have already been accused a few times of being not being PC, of being ethnocentric. Somebody said there was a smell of racism about my book about the Arabs, but I deny that. I really feel as if I have applied the same standards of examination to the Arabs as I have to the Jews, and sometimes the result is not positive. And when it's not positive, I think, as a writer, I've got to say that.
What are the PC landmines that you have to deal with as a journalist covering the Middle East?
Well, I'm kind of interested in the big picture, if I can say that, and I take a very careful look at Islam because I think Islam is the foundation of Arab civilization. And I don't say anything critical about Islam any more than I say anything critical about Judaism, because I think as a body of theology, A, I am not a theologian, but as a body of theology, they're both fine. It's who has taken over this body of theology, whether it be Judaism or Islam, and used it for the political purposes that they see they would like to achieve. And I think that just as Rabbi Kahana and his Orthodox colleagues have hijacked Judaism and made it into a right-wing political ideology, which I think there is little justification for, I think over the course of time, people have taken over Islam and made it into a highly restricted, highly limited dogma, which allows no room for intellectual exploration, for doubt, for challenge of orthodoxy. I mean, the West was like that 1,000 years ago, and we went through many, many bloody wars in order for the right of free thought to prevail, and basically it has, although there are certain people even within our society who would deny that right when they can. But that still hasn't taken place within the Arab world, and it's a significant problem for them.
For many years now, you've been talking to Israelis and to Arabs about the Middle East. Are there specific areas that you think both sides have blind spots about when thinking of the other?
Well, certainly both sides have blind spots about the past of the other. It is very hard to find an Arab who understands the depth of the feelings of the Jews about not only not having their own land, but what not having their own land has cost them in terms of the suffering they have experienced at largely Christian, not Arab hands. So I think that it's very hard. I mean, it's very hard for one people to put their thinking processes, their sympathy, their sympathetic examination into the minds of another. Well, the same thing is certainly true of the Jews in dealing with the Arabs. The Arabs have had a difficult and complex history. They have suffered a great deal at the hands of many peoples. I would argue that much of it may very well be their own responsibility, but be that as it may, I think it is incumbent upon Jews to make some sort of effort to understand what the Arabs are about.
Milton Viorst is the author of Sandcastles, The Arabs in Search of the Modern World. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.